Well, the thing is, I've never done this before and I forgot. But at the priest retreat of 1989, I think Jean would have been there, Hans probably was, yes. And this was from Mario to JR, so I'll read it out so you know where he's coming from and what he's actually doing. Mario says, "You have got things back to front. Now I understand. I've got bad news for you. That's what your soul desires, but not God. One is not prepared for ages and ages and ages just to fiddle." Pardon me saying that about music. "There are three areas in which you must express yourself, John, to be very brief. One is music and the expression of it, thank God I say. The second one is teaching, indeed, and not necessarily in the way that you're teaching now at a school, but certainly within the centre, within the chosen people of God, within those circles where truth can be given. The third one is to change." No, let me rephrase that. "To open up your clairvoyant abilities greater and better so you can step into my shoes. So shall it be." Now, at the time, many people took that slightly the wrong way. They thought he was going to step into Mario's shoes altogether, which JR knew was not what was going on, because we have plenty of absolutely superb teachers here. I think even Hans was teaching JR at first. And we have Kenneth Colleen. We have some absolutely wonderful teachers in our midst. So we're all very capable of taking that task on. What Mario really meant, and Jay, I knew this at the time, was to step into his shoes of clairvoyance. And clairvoyance took him many, many years to train in. It is not something you do overnight. It was years and years and years. And we've been doing the readings for 30 years now, including the New Year reading. So I'm sorry for the interruption, darling, but I have finished. And I've said what I needed to say. I really wanted to say that today. And you have my permission to proceed. Love you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I think clairvoyance is a very tricky concept, and our work in the way of the wise art and in the temple is in fact to develop clairvoyance. And so I would like each of you to be part of this tonight, and I would like us to imagine. Close your eyes if it helps, certainly helps me. And over your home, over your city, over Australia, over whatever you like to consider it, I want you to imagine there's this vast golden dome, geodesic dome. It's made of golden fibres and it's sparkling. And through this dome, all sorts of beings are descending gradually, like feathers floating in the air. And some of them are little sparks, little golden sparks, and they represent souls who've been attracted or who are drawn to the Melchizedek temple tonight. And some are very high spiritual beings. And In the communion with these beings, we will experience that the order of Melchizedek embraces not just a few people, as Mario would call it, not just a few bods here and there, but an evolutionary impulse that enters into the DNA, the spiritual DNA of our consciousness, and works there to transform, often in a very quiet way, often unseen, but to transform the understandings and the perceptions of our cultures. And if you will imagine that, then I can relay to you the experiences or the vision that stands before me. And I'm standing in darkness, absolute darkness. It's like a cave. But it's not a cave because it doesn't have a roof, it's just dark. And from the heavens, as it were, slowly floating down to earth, is a young woman. She's got red hair, and she carries a golden key in her hand. And she's dressed in a sort of a light blue robe. And she reaches my level and she says, "This is the consciousness of humanity at present." And I'm looking in absolute amazement and I say to her, "But it's so dark." And she said, "Yes, we are in a dark period of evolution at present." And she says, "But there is always a way out of the darkness." And she directs my attention to a door that stands in front of me. And I go to open the door, but the door is locked. And she takes the golden key and she puts it into the key lock and she opens the lock and the door swings open. And we walk into what appears to be a very large cave. And all around there are souls, I guess they are, sitting. They're performing activities, but I'm not sure how to describe this because, in the one sense, they are, I know they're human beings, but in another sense, they're animals. And here is a group of souls depicted as pigs, and they're pushing and elbowing one another to get at a trough full of dirty oatmeal or whatever it is. Swill. Pig swill, I guess. And on the other side there, I guess there's a group of rabbits, souls that are rabbits. And on the other side, another place, there are souls that are hyenas. And my guide says to me that this is the region where human consciousness at its most basic level exists. It's an animal consciousness. And the souls that you see in the form of pigs, they are the souls who've been given so much in the way of wealth and power, and they have no regard for anyone else. They're just pushing and shoving one another to get more money, more wealth, more power, more possessions, more of everything. And I'm looking at the rabbits, and they're running around, and they're oblivious to everything, and they're having a wonderful time, and my guide says. And then there are the souls who turn their back on any success in the world, and they are content just to live day to day and to have whatever fun and entertainment they can get. They're the ones who are on their mobile phones all the time and hitting Facebook and Insta and TikTok and just living in a moment that is illusory. And then there's the hyenas who lurk in the background, and she says, and these are the ones who will come in and take over when all the others reach a point where they can no longer go on. And I say to her, but this is a very bleak picture of human consciousness. And she says, yes, this is just the lowest level of human consciousness. And she takes me to the next door and opens that, and I'm looking out on a globe, a world globe, and it's surrounded by flames as though the world itself is on fire. And she says, this is your world. It should be beautiful. It should be full of, it should be peaceful. It should be an expression of love, but it has been infiltrated by the power of the flames. And the flames are the energies, spiritual energies, if you like, of desire. So our world is on fire at present. We're walking now through what looks like a forest. It's a very tangled forest. There are trees leaning over. There are little huts, little houses dotted around. And the people inside the houses are too afraid to come out, and each house is surrounded by a fence. Sometimes it's a fence of stones, and sometimes it's a fence of brambles. And I say, where are we now? And she says, we are in the forest of lost souls. These are the souls who've passed from incarnation where they did not receive the light, where they were so focused on what they wanted, what they desired, and they were souls very often who were bound by, she's trying to explain it to me, and it's as though you can be bound by so many things. You can even be bound by love and caring. But they were bound by possession. I think that's the right word. And when they pass out of the body into the spiritual worlds, they are still bound by their possessions, and they are still bound by their understanding. But these souls, we can do something about. And one of the reasons that in our order, soul masses are so significant is that when we do a soul mass, we can shine light into that house, into that cottage where these souls have locked themselves away. And sometimes there's enough light so they can even find the door and walk out. We're moving faster now. We're moving through grey clouds. We're moving, and I can feel it higher into more pure realms of consciousness, the higher astral realms. And there's a beautiful blue light that surrounds, like a blue mist. And now I'm standing at the beginning of a long path. And the path on the left-hand side has seven towering flames, pillars of fire, if you like, and they're red, orange, yellow, and they're full of heat and energy. And then on the right-hand side are seven smaller flames opposite their red counterparts. And these flames burn with a sort of a coolness. They don't harm. They are pure light, and at the core of each of these is the color blue. And we start walking along this path, and I look up and I see that we're walking towards an enormous temple, and it's a temple almost in the style of an Indian temple. If you've seen pictures of the Taj Mahal, it looks a little bit like that. But we're walking to this temple and we're walking past each flame in turn. And when I look at the flames, there is a being inside each flame. And the red flames, the beings are imprisoned. For them, it's a torture. But on the in the white flames, the beings are healing and restoring and integrating. We reach the temple and the doors are open, so we walk in, and the space is immense. And there are many beings, many souls assembled here with us. And we're standing in a sort of a semicircle around the central point. And the central point is a large rectangular pool. And on the other side of the pool from where I am, there is a man or a being who looks like some sort of king, and he's got a crown on his head, and his hair is white, and his beard is white, and he sits above the pool, and that's all I can. I can only see the upper half of him, but the pool reflects his image back, but instead of the exact image of the wise old ruler, there's an image there. The reflection is quite different. This is a person who's dark, whose eyes burn with fire and with desire and longing and avarice. And both of these beings hold scepters in their hand, so that the king that I see at first, sitting on the edge of the pool, has a scepter in his right hand, but when it's reflected, the image has a scepter in their left hand. And I'm wondering what all this means. What do the flames mean? What is the reflection that isn't a reflection means? And the whole scene of the pool and the reflected king's dissolves, and in its place is a being who looks very much like, Martin, you'll like this, the emperor in the tarot card. He's got a crown on his head, his hair is white, his beard is white, his eyes stream with wisdom, and he holds a scepter in his right hand. He sits on a throne. And he starts to speak, and his voice is like thunder. So it's so loud, I almost have to put my hand over my ears, but my guide puts her hands over my ears, and after a while, the sound diminishes, or my hearing can cope, and I can hear what is being said. And the speaker says something like this: "We have arrived at a crucial moment in human evolution. Not just this year, but the last year, this year, the year to come, and the year after that will mark cataclysmic, no, that's not the right word, epochal, there's a sense that eludes me. He's talking about change that is so significant that the world will not be the same again. And he says the spiritual beings who guide human evolution have sent immense power, immense energy into the world this century so far. And there are two particular points where the spiritual powers that guide and lead humanity have entered into the world. And the first is that there is a new Christ bearer come into incarnation, and this individual will, in time to come, bring a new impulse of Christ, a new understanding of Christ into the world. And the second point of pivotal point at this in the century has been the entry of Mary into the world once again. And Mary, the feminine consciousness, was taken out of the world for about 200 years. Even though there was a lot of Marian devotion, the feminine was lifted out so that the masculine energies could progress, that they could think, mentate, design, pontificate, plan, invent. And all these masculine energies, you don't have to be a man to be able to think and pontificate, of course. You can be a masculine soul in a female body quite happily, have all those attributes. But this masculine energy has moved humanity for the last 400 or 500 years to a point where it is the only species now capable of facilitating or even initiating its own self-destruction. So that Mary once again descended into human consciousness, I think in the year 2010, between 2010 and 2012. And already the rise of the feminine expression is being experienced by many people and many souls who have that sensitivity and facility to connect with the Mary consciousness. But whenever there is an influx of energy and power from the evolutionary, the beings that guide evolution, there arises a matching influx of negativity and constraint that it's a bit like a wave coming in. The wave comes in and it reaches a certain point, but then the wave inevitably has to go out again. And we're seeing at the moment the retreat of the evolutionary wave. It went to a certain point about the year 2010, and from then on, and perhaps before then, it started moving backwards, so that the fundamental leading edge of human consciousness is no longer to make change, and it's no longer to look after other people. It's no longer to empathize. It's no longer to look for human, to uphold human dignity. It's no longer to uphold the rule of law, although that's a bad expression because sometimes the rule of law is not much of a rule. But let us say the principle of justice. So we are experiencing, as it were, not a collision, but a separation of the energies that will advance human evolution and the energies that actually would not just retard it, but would halt it completely. And he says, this is the year of the flame. And I'm thinking, what is the year of the flame? I understand what it might be if it was the year of fire, that would mean a year of energy and a year of initiating things and getting things done and getting out there and making things happen. But the year of flame, and he says, when you came in, he's addressing all of us there. You passed down the avenue of the seven flames. The seven flames are the seven spirits before the throne. They are the seven creative impulses, but they have been split into two. The flames that were on your left as you entered, those flames are the flames of desire, what perhaps the Buddha would have called attachment. That is, they rise up within the human soul and they create a conversation that says, I don't have enough. Who I am is not enough. I must become more. I must become greater. I must become, if I'm a millionaire, I must become a more wealthy millionaire. If I'm a healer, I must become a greater healer. If I'm a musician, I must become a greater musician. This flame always wants to go higher, and it burns with an intensity that burns the soul. We each have these seven flames within us. They are, as it were, associated with the seven spiritual centers, so that the flame associated with the gonad center says, I'm going to use sex to conquer and destroy and to assault and as a weapon to hurt other souls. And if you're living from the flame within the, say, the heart center, then that speaks to you and says, I cannot love anyone else unless they love me first. And then it says, oh, love is just a myth. Love is a metaphor. Love doesn't exist. It's not real. And instead of finding love within relationships, when this flame takes over, then we have relationships that turn toxic and become dependent and codependent. And instead of freeing the souls become enslaved. But fortunately, we also have the white flames within the human psyche, within the spiritual centers, and they are always urging us to become less. And perhaps that sounds strange. The red flames urge us to become more wealthy, more sexy, more talented, more gifted, more powerful, more influential. The white flames say, have a different voice entirely. They say, no, let it go. Release it. Release your desire for wealth. Release your desire for power. Release your desire for more of whatever it is, more fame, more influence, more children. Release it. Let it go. And there is I've got to put this in different words. He says that up until the incarnation of Christ, the human soul only had, or the human soul only had the red flames operating. They had been corrupted over thousands of years, and perhaps we know that story. But when Christ came, he walked on this earth, and when he walked in certain places, he created the opposite flame, the white flame, if you like. And so now the seeds of Christ consciousness are growing in each of us. And to talk about how they work in specifics is far outside our time here. But then there is one last aspect that you need to know. In the year of flame, you will see old institutions destroyed, not just physical institutions, although those too will go. It's a year of It's a fire year, which means that in the physical world, there will be terrible expressions of fire, expressions of war, of conquest, of attack, of bombs. There is a pitilessness about the flame. That's why we can have thousands and thousands of people killed in the name of religion, in the name of democracy, in the name of all sorts of wonderful institutions that have been taken over and are simply burning with this flame. But the symbol of the two kings, the king above the water, the king below the water, is a teaching that says the opposites are an illusion. The red flame is not really opposed to the white flame. That eventually, as we progress as spiritual beings, the red and the white must come together and unite and create something greater. And it's easy to talk about Christ forces, Michael forces, Aramanic forces, Luciferic forces. It's easy to talk about this, but that's only on a limited level of consciousness, that there is no division. The ultimate reality, the Godhead, if you like, is all one. And the path to achieving that unity of consciousness, which is the only help, the only way our world can move forward, is to become aware within ourselves of what we want and then to let it go. And in that moment, a unity appears. It is impossible to overestimate the power of oneness, the power of unity, the power of a union. And it's not a union of minds, of discussion, of thinking, of sitting down at a table and balancing out nice arguments. It's not that at all. It's a unity where one moves to the feeling levels. And without being able to explain, we suddenly feel something in the other soul. And in that feeling, into that soul, that is clairvoyance. That's real clairvoyance. Because in that feeling, we have left everything that is judgmental, everything that is analytical behind us. And we, in feeling into that soul, we have given something of our own soul to that other individual. The scene is fading now, and I'm still with my guide, and she's holding my right hand, and we seem to be moving through the blue mist again. And then we've come to the door, and I know what this door is. This is the door to the meeting room, the boardroom, Melody sometimes calls it. And we enter in, and I'm there with the other representatives of the order for this year. And the speaker is, well, that's a really interesting joke. It's a joke because the speaker has represented himself as King Arthur, and we're the knights around the round table. So I think the speaker is having a bit of fun with us, because I don't think any of us particularly feel like we're worthy knights. But there we are. There are 12 of us. And the speaker says that in this time, in this year, and the year to come, and the year after, our work as the Melchizedek Order is to be there to pour water on the flames, to soothe the souls of those who've been burned in the world, and to allow, perhaps through the sacrifice of self, but to allow the truth to emerge. And the flames, the red flames, they are the what Jesus calls in the Gospel of St. John, the lie. They are the lie. So that their purpose, the work in the world, is to generate lies and falsehood and misinformation and denial. And so our job as priests is to stand in the shoes of our founder, our Lord the Christ, and say with him, I am the truth. I am the way. I am the way, the truth, and the light, the life. And we don't have to get into arguments with people, but we do have to be very aware of the illusions that are spun. And sometimes these illusions are very, very convincing. But the funny thing is, the order doesn't go out and preach. It doesn't get on Facebook and say, oh, this is my page for truth. That's the opposition's job. They'll create a website or an online platform called Truth Social or something like that, and they will misuse the word truth. So our work is not to announce the truth, it's to be the truth and to live from that truth. The greatest peril in the world at present is that truth is being drowned out in an ocean of deceit and misinformation. And from the ocean, as Revelation says, the beast arrives, and there are a couple of beasts in the world at present. I won't name them because that's makes us then perhaps enter into the politics of the world, which is also associated with the lie very often. But our job is to be like Michael, who will one day take the sword of truth and slay the beasts. And in the meantime, we are part of the army of Michael, and it's our job to live the truth and to express the truth in our thoughts, deeds, our actions, waking and sleeping. I think we'll take questions. Thank you, Melody.
It seemed to be quite a lot of questions this year about death, and I was going to ask a question about that truth. Whatever happened to the truth that we now see has turned into a huge lie? So thank you, you've already answered my question. And I thought I'd just take a question from Imance first, where he says, what happens to the soul, astral, and etheric bodies of those that die with no spiritual knowledge?
What happens to the soul, astral, and etheric bodies to those who deny, to those who die without spiritual knowledge? Yeah. Well, it really, really comes down to what is spiritual knowledge. Really, we if you spent years at the center, if you became part of OMC, if you went to the college, you would learn all sorts of spiritual knowledge. You'd learn about astral bodies, etheric bodies, three-part soul. You'd learn about the seven incarnations, the epochs of the earth. You'd learn lots and lots of things. You might learn a bit about what happens to you when you die. And I hate to break it to you, but that ain't spiritual knowledge. That's just intellectual knowledge. And it might be really interesting. And you might have learned certain techniques along the way. You might have learned healing techniques or meditation techniques or psychological techniques, but none of it is spiritual knowledge. Spiritual knowledge is a knowledge of your reality of who you are as a spiritual being. Now, you don't actually have to belong to a church or a spiritual movement or do a course to have that spiritual knowledge. The knowledge of self can be gathered by anyone who lives a life where they become aware of the results and consequences of their own actions. Now, this is where the flames come in, you see, because the red flames, that's part of your consciousness that says, that wants you to ignore consequences, that wants you to act out of reaction, instinct, what seems right at the time. That's all, that's really great stuff, yes. But it's the white flame that we have to cultivate. And if we become aware of our actions and our thoughts, we can't become aware of our actions unless we become aware of our thoughts. One should lead to the other. Then we create a light because we empower that beautiful white flame, the Christ flame within self. And so we start to radiate out light. Now, you can be an atheist and radiate out light. If you've lived a life
I'll stop.
where you have been considerate towards other people, where you've expressed love, where you've been kind, where you have been generous, all of these things, they will take you into the spiritual worlds with a lot of light. So if we can understand that that's what spiritual knowledge is, not even reading the works of the Reverend Mario. He told us not to do that, of course, but to live from the love that is within us, to emanate from the heart center. Then, even if you don't believe there's nothing after death, that's fine. You'll pass over into the spiritual worlds. And because you expected that there was nothing there, you'll just be quite happily in darkness. And you'll say to yourself, oh, see, I told them there was nothing there. There isn't nothing, nothing, nothing at all. Can't see a thing. And then all of a sudden, it will strike you, well, if there's nothing there, why am I still thinking? And then something will happen. Perhaps someone will pull a curtain back and gradually let in the light. And then you'll be allowed out, or you'll be able to walk out into a different world and a different realm of consciousness. And then you'll be guided and helped to heal from the incarnation. And sometimes people incarnate to have a specifically non-religious slash spiritual incarnation, because they might have had an incarnation prior where they misused spiritual power or religious authority. And so that consciousness, religious spiritual consciousness, is taken away from them so that they can learn to achieve without misusing that authority. So there is no one size fits all answer. I'm sorry, I'm answered. It will depend on whether this person loved others in his life or whether they developed into a very cold-hearted, grasping individual. In which case, if that happens, then they will end up in what I've already described as the Forest of Lost Souls, which is souls create their own afterlife, you see. So it's not that God is vengeful or judgmental. That's our job. When we pass through the gates, which are not really pearly, but when we pass through those gates, we get to chat with ourselves, and we go through what so many religious cultures call a judgment. And there is an accuser and there is a defender. And the ancient Egyptians put it really nicely that you have a pair of scales that represents your life. And on the right-hand side is your soul, and on the left-hand side is a feather. And the feather is truth, ma'at, truth. And if your soul has been truthful, then the scale with the feather in just wins. It descends, and your soul goes into freedom. But if the soul has not been truthful, then it has to ad adapt to that, because when one lies, when we create, we start creating a fence around ourselves. First of all, if we lie from the head in order to gain advantage, we start creating a sort of an armor, like a dark fence, so that we stop being able to perceive after a while what the truth really is. In the beginning, we may lie quite consciously and say, oh, I'm doing this for a good cause, or because I don't want to get hurt, or because I want to gain something, but I know I'm lying. But then after a while, we can't see that we're lying. And so we lose control of a certain part of our mind and our thinking ability. We might be very, very smart. We might still outmaneuver the competition, but we have lost something of who we are. So, if the soul goes out without a spiritual consciousness, without truth, without having lived a life of truth and love, then it will go into a place where it will have to spend some time in discovering what it did and dismantling the barriers. And sometimes souls feel so bad about themselves that they shut themselves away, and you they don't no one can talk to them. But that is where the priesthood comes in, isn't it? That's why we do soul masses. That's why we do prayers for the dead, why we talk to them, talk to the people who've departed. Sometimes they'll answer back. Sometimes they'll tap you on the shoulder and say, hey, don't forget about me. But live in that consciousness where someone is not dead, but someone but continues forever. I think that's enough. Thank you, Melody.
Okay, I was sitting in the doctor's office when I got a huge bang on my left shoulder, and it was from Sally, and she wanted to be remembered as a priest, which fits very well into the next question that comes from Carolyn about, is there an implication, a karmic result? For anyone in engaging in what we call voluntary assisted dying, what are the consequences of such an act?
Thank you, Carolyn. I think the short answer is that there are no consequences of deciding to complete your life rather than experience months or years perhaps of terrible pain and suffering. Part of the problem is actually that we're living too long. I should be just about gone by now, and I'm only in my 70s. And I'm obviously looking forward to having a few more years amongst you all. But I remember when 70 was old. No, 70 is not old. Even 80 is not old. I'm going to be there soon. So 90, no, that's just a walk in the park. No, we are actually living too long because our clever medical scientists have discovered how to keep decrepit, decaying physical bodies ticking along for years and years when 100 years ago, people would have just died. They wouldn't have been able to stay alive. Now, in a sense, this intervention is outside what spirit wants. Spirit doesn't really need us to be tortured. If you need to be tortured because of karma, that would happen to you between the age of 30 and 49 normally, wouldn't it? Because that's when karma comes up. So that this extra suffering, this is needless. The spiritual worlds have not set it in place. If you arrive at that stage where you know that you have only that you've got no more quality of life left, and by that I mean there is nothing more that you can do on this earth to help other souls. That's what I mean by quality of life. We get quality of life from assisting and helping. If you've arrived at that stage and you're in so much pain, and you know that there's no going back, you're definitely going to die. Well, there's absolutely no penalty whatsoever. My personal recommendation would be that if you knew someone who was going down that track, to encourage them to have a devotional element in their life. Because the soul that passes out of the body after a long period of pain and medical treatment often enters into the spiritual world in fear and confusion. So what we need to have happen to make sure that the soul is prepared for that step is devotion. Focus on Christ, of course. That's what I would say. But if you're a Buddhist, I guess you focus on the Buddha. If you're, I don't know what you focus on. If you're Islamic, perhaps the angel Gabriel. He had a pretty important part to play. But devotion and spiritual practice, they are the royal path to finishing up this life. Thank you.
Thank you, and that is a completely different story from suicide. Completely different story, and it's very, very well regulated in Australia, especially in Victoria. So thank you for that question, Carolyn. Now I have a question from Ross, who asks about the Australian folk spirit. What is its nature and current work? How can we assist it?
Oh, just for fun, Ross, I'll tell you that the symbol of the Australian folk spirit is an emu. And the symbol of the overself of Australia at present is an emu with its head in the sand. So the folk spirit will do its work, but it needs to have, how can I put it? It needs to have consciousness. The folk spirit itself actually is not quite conscious. It's that's why its symbol is an emu. And it needs to have interaction with humanity. That's where it gets its consciousness from. And we can help it by loving Australia. That's easy. There's not much that most of us can do. We can't go out and stop deforestation, and we can't go out and save endangered species. This is all part of the trauma that the folk spirit is presently experiencing. But on the other hand, the folk spirit is strongest in rural Australia, and it's particularly in what we call the outback. And if you want to see the centre of manifestation of the Australian folk spirit, you go to Uluru. Now, at Uluru, there's another presence, and that's the Archangel of Australia. And whereas the folk spirit works from the earth up,
Want to turn it
the
on.
Archangel of Australia works from the heavens down, and they unite in a symbolic sense at Uluru. And if you go there, you might see that conversation happening, as it were. And since Christ died on the cross, and his blood, or Christ himself, entered into the underworld, the folk spirits of all the nations are now permeated also with the Christ force, which means that there will be a greater consciousness of the spirits, of nature, in years to come. And already some of the old, very old spirits are wakening up. There's a place in Tasmania, which John Pattinson knows well, and so does Fabian, called Mount Roland. And that was home to a very, very ancient, very important spirit. And when John and Annette went to settle there, this being started to awaken. So we don't actually have to do anything, but we have to be beings who live in truth and allow our senses and our experience to open up, so that our consciousness can enter into the consciousness of the Australian spirit. And I do notice that the symbol of the overself, which used to be the, as I said, the emu with its head buried in the sand, has actually, the emu's just about got its head out of the sand right now. It's looking around a little bit bemused, as though to say, well, what's going on here? What do I have to do? Where's me mates? And this represents that there is an awakening coming to Australia, and awakenings are not easy. So there is a time coming when we will have to decide which side we want to be on. And it's not, how can I put it, it's not this side or that side, it's the side of truth. The side of goodness, to put another word to it. Think that's enough. Thanks, Melody.
Okay, a question from Peter McRae re Bondi shooting. My understanding is that souls choose their time of death, but not necessarily how they will die. So, did these 16 souls choose to pass over at Bondi because it was their time? To move on, your question.
Reverend Mario said about the Port Arthur shooting that There was not one person there by accident. Every person was there by appointment. And I think the same is true here, Peter, that every single soul is there by appointment. But it's not, you see, the spiritual process is not mechanical, because otherwise the gunman would have come in with the destiny of having to pick up weapons and shoot innocent people. Now, no soul is going to come in with that destiny. That wasn't their destiny. They didn't come in with that destiny. But when they made the choices that they did, when their consciousness became so dark that they deemed this was a necessary deed, action that they had to carry out, then spirit weaves, which controls or weaves all of us into this complex living tapestry, arranged it so that when each person who was killed died, it completed their life too, their life purpose. So that although they didn't come in to be shot, they did not incarnate to be shot, when decisions were made, the spiritual hierarchy pulls the threads of the tapestry in certain directions, so that in the end, as we say, perfect justice rules the world. Thank you, Melody.
That's brilliant, thank you. Think I'll go to Becky now. So again, it's about intellectual knowledge to begin with, but also there's a great deal of love in her soul, I know that. What happens to the soul, astral, and etheric bodies of those that die, have knowledge of God, but not reincarnation?
Absolutely nothing, Beck. You don't have to know about reincarnation to die. In fact, most people who die don't know about reincarnation, and there's no penalty for not having attended the class and or missed the class on reincarnation when you get to the other side. You know, reincarnation was taken out of the West deliberately. You
Yeah.
can find traces of it in, if you look back, certainly. It was a common understanding in the ancient world amongst anyone who had a bit of education that we died and we went through a period between the worlds, and we came back. And the funny thing is that one of the earliest writers to describe this is Plato in the Republic, Book 10, and you'll find there that he has described almost perfectly the dying and the incarnating process. So, and you also, of course, find traces in the New Testament. That's why Jesus tells the disciples that John the Baptist was Elijah, who was to come. So there's no doubt that reincarnation at the time of Christ was well understood and quite widely accepted. But as Christianity and then later Islam evolved, their purpose was to close off the memories of the spiritual worlds so that people would come into incarnation thinking they only had one life and by God they'd better make it count because there were no second chances. Of course, we know that there are second chances. And that can sometimes cause a certain spiritual laziness because you can say, well, I didn't do it this time. Perhaps I'll come back and do it next time. I'd really love to play the harmonica in my life, But I think it's just too much trouble. I'll play it in my next life. Or I'd like to pick up a paintbrush and be a great artist, but I'd rather have a beer. I think I'll just come back next life and try being an artist then, and so on and so forth. So you're not allowed to understand reincarnation until you reach a certain spiritual point of spiritual evolution. Now, most people who go out of the body and have near-death experiences, reincarnation is never mentioned, 99.9% of the time. So spirit doesn't think it's very important. What spirit thinks is important when you go out is what sort of life have you led? What sort of consciousness have you created? What sort of truth have you manifested? How have you expressed love in your life? These are the things that your soul is concerned with when you get out. And believe me, when you get out of this body, reincarnation is the last thing you want to think about. Most of us are so glad to get out, we never want to come back. We have to be dragged kicking and screaming. The proctors have to come and get us from the halls where we're having a lovely time in spirit, and they grab us by the arms, one on each side, and say, "Okay, JR, it's time to go back." And I'm saying, No, I don't want to go back. It was so ghastly last time. Can't I stay a bit longer? No, back you go." So, yeah, reincarnation, forget about it for the next life, and don't worry about trying to convince someone else of reincarnation. You'll never do it. But spirit has very magical ways of working, and spirit, there's no proof of reincarnation, but there can be evidence, and spirit is gradually, surreptitiously piling up evidence and data of reincarnation in all sorts of unexpected places. So by the time we come back in, I expect we'll understand reincarnation, so it won't be a hassle problem that way either. That's it. Thanks, Melody.
You're hilarious.
Perfect.
I think Dane was telling us one evening about the written experiences of reincarnation, and actually there are quite a few around, aren't there? So proof or no proof, there is some sort of story out there from some people who've had that experience. Now, I've got one more question from Peter, and it's an important question, I think, as have they all been. Can you comment on the future development of the temple, please?
Oh, this is very, very brief. But the temple is evolving. So far, we have created the etheric body, and that's because the purpose of the temple up to this stage has been to manifest Christ in the etheric so that it can be seen with the etheric eyes. But even greater purpose beyond us is that we are manifesting Christ on the etheric of the world through the very non-Christed telecommunications system. You can tell Zoom is not very Christed because when we all sing together, we're all out of sync. So that's definitely not Christ. That's got to be the other guys. So the next stage in the temple will be to develop the astral. And the temple needs to change in the next 2 years, and I won't say anything more about it now. But as more people come in, we are going to have to think of ways of making re change changing the structure so that we don't get too large a group, but rather that we have smaller groups, perhaps run by different people. And each group might have a different function, but this will be revealed over the next year or the next couple of years, I think. I think I've got to stop here because, according to my clock, we've just about completed one CD full of reading.
Okay, you sure? Has anybody else got a question? No. All right. Well, that's the end of that part. What shall we do now? We don't have to put this on the CD. This can be recorded off.
We can have a margarita.
Margarita. Yeah, that was pretty good, wasn't it, Christine? Did you like it? I can't hear a word you're saying, by the way. But everybody's muted themselves, so.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Yeah.
Yes.
Fantastic.
I said it was wonderful, and I loved the humor towards the end. I really enjoyed that.
I always love the humor myself. I'm married to a very, very funny man, but do you know what you did, darling? You told me you can't come back because your life was so terrible. I had to piss myself laughing over that. Oh, shut up.
Melody, I'd like to leave now. It's 10:30 at night. It's past my bedtime.
Please, sweetheart Jan,
Thank you
go
very
and
much
lots
for
of love.
including me. Most enjoyable. Love to you all.
Yeah.
Love you.
Back to you, Jen.
Bye. Hey,
Uh-oh.
shall we
We're in
say
much the
goodbye
same
to each
position.
other?
We're going to go too
Yes.
because that's the time we are as well. So I'll see
Okay,
you.
you
See
go.
you soon. Bye-bye.
Make sure you
Bye.
have sex. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
Dean, do you
Yeah.
have to go too?
Yeah, we've all got to go.
We've all got to go, JR says.
All going. Yeah,
Frank, thank
I'll
you for
stop it.
coming.
Thank you for coming.
Bye.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye.
We
Thank
love
you.
bye.
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 Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
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 Thank you.
Bye.
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 Bye.